Good evening, it's Jason Godby for No Rest of the Weekend, and I'm here at the Regal Cinema in Union Square for a special screening of Scream 6. Review will be coming shortly. To be completely honest, I am not the biggest Scream fan. I saw the first one back in 1996, so I'm hoping I'll get this movie. Should be interesting. So I'm here with Danny Mendez, who writes reviews for us sometimes. He is also the man behind CineBuff.com. You just saw the movie. What did you think?
It was exponentially better than the one from 2022, in my opinion. I think most of the characters get their chance to shine because it doesn't really focus on the legacy characters like the ones from 2022. So this one was a nice change of pace. The characters are pretty fun. The kills are entertaining.
I thought it was really thrilling. I found it was more like a thriller than a horror. Like
I can agree with that.
I didn't think it was like... I didn't find it very scary, but I found it very suspenseful.
It feels like a whodunit.
Right, which is something that the Scream franchise has always done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not the most familiar person with the Scream franchise. Can you give us a little background?
Basically, the first one, high school girl Sydney Prescott, one of her friends is murdered, and they think that she might be linked to it because she has a past history of her mom being mentally unstable, her father accused of being a killer as well. So then, basically, the franchise centers around her from 1, 2, and 3. It's Sydney Prescott's movie. From then on, it's about entirely new characters. There's no Sydney Prescott in this movie at all. She was in the previous one, but for a brief moment.
Now, this is a non-spoiler review, non-spoiler reaction. We can't say anything. Would you recommend this one?
Absolutely. I think this one's a lot of fun, especially if you're in a packed theater like the one we were just in. You're going to get a lot out of it.
We had a lot of Scream fans.
Yes, a lot of Scream fans. You'll have people clapping. They recognize certain characters. It's fun, especially if you're a Scream fan. You'll really enjoy it.
Yeah, we had some nice appearances from some of the legacy characters in this one. It is fun. You know, my main problem with Scream is it possible to be too meta? You know, like, this movie is so...
This one is really meta. I like the first one because it's meta, but it's not so in your face about it. The last one and this one, I think it's a little too meta for its own... It tries to be in on the joke, but it just feels...
These people know they're in a horror movie.
Yeah, exactly. I like it when it's not going too hard on that.
I feel like my biggest problem, too, is like when these, you know, this grisly murder happens and somebody's best friend or their lover or something like that, and then they, 5 minutes later, they're making jokes about it.
Yeah, it lacks that sort of the stakes, I guess, and then when something bad happens, there's a joke. It feels like a Marvel movie, I think. Very modern, where there's always a joke, nothing's really taken seriously.
Yeah, something bad happens, undercut it with a joke.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you're a Scream fan, I would recommend it. I think it was a lot of fun. Good performances all the way around.
Great performances. I agree with that.
Even though you mentioned the dialogue is a little clunky in places.
Yeah. It's clunky. Script itself too. Very convenient in some points.
Yeah. Like, well, how did that person end up here?
And especially, when you see the ending, you'll know it was.
Right, we can't give anything away. By the way, shout out and thanks to the good people at Brooklyn Horror Film Festival who gave us the passes to come here to the special screening. It was a lot of fun, though. I think that I haven't kept up with the franchise. The other thing I like that they did was that I felt like, for me, who hadn't seen anything but the first one,
mm-hmm.
they did a good job of recapping everything so that you could come
it's
in.
It's easy to follow along.
Yeah. Good, solid beginning. I think the beginning with the, it's got a typical Scream beginning. Can't give anything away. But it's got some great twists and turns, and it's a lot of fun.
I had a great time. I can't complain. I like thrillers like this very early in the year, you know, when there's not... You don't get the big blockbusters and you get something like this. It's a nice evening at the movies.
All right. So that's all from the sneak preview of Scream 6. Look for more content at NoRestForTheWeekendPodcast.com and follow us on social at NoRestForTheWeekend. And follow Dan at
TheCineBuff.com.
All right. Thanks. Good night. I thought Scream 6 was quite entertaining. There are some genuinely suspenseful sequences in it, but I will say there are a number of plot contrivances that may leave you scratching your head. You might wonder how who got to be where. There are also instances of people being violently stabbed multiple times only to be seemingly unaffected and able to run around later. In one instance, one of our young heroes is nearly gutted by Ghostface, but is still able to crawl across a ladder between apartment buildings. Another character is stabbed countless times and manages to somehow live in the end. It's shocking when it happens and you say to yourself, oh, I can't believe they killed that guy, but then he lives, which completely undermines the suspense. It feels like people can be stabbed or shot and not die depending on their level of importance to the franchise. Also, our main characters are all young and gorgeous and pretty much remain that way after being stabbed and narrowly surviving harrowing experiences. All these things take me out of the movie. It's like not only do the paramedics arrive at the end, but also the hair and makeup team showed up. All in all, this is a turn-your-brain-off popcorn film. I did have a good time, especially having seen the film with a bunch of Scream fans. If you don't feel like you need to see this one in the theater, definitely catch it on streaming. You don't have to have seen all the films, but you may want to have checked out the previous film just so you get introduced to this new group of characters. I will say it was refreshing to see a real rated R movie in a theater. There's gruesome violence and foul language. It's not watered down PG-13 violence. And I think a lot of films who are going for this type of impact could benefit from that. As for the future of the franchise, I don't know where they go at this point. The ending gets pretty ridiculous, so I'm not sure how much more over the top or meta things can get. But rest assured, it'll be interesting to see what they do in Scream 7. I enjoyed this movie. I enjoyed Living with Chucky. I'm a sucker for behind the scenes documentary stuff. I, like you, not Child's Play fans, but of course we remember those movies existed. We remember the character. It just wasn't in my lexicon. But I thought the documentary had some great interviews. She talked to Don Mancini, who created the whole saga, Brad Dourif, the voice of Chucky, Jennifer Tilly, the bride of Chucky, Billy Boyd, who was the seed of Chucky, and then we had people like Marlon Wayans, John Waters, and Abigail Breslin. Now, I learned a lot about the franchise and the people who made it. It takes you right through the Chucky saga. So we start with film one in 1988, and we go all the way up to present day. And the last act of the film is where Gardner finally appears, and you see her actually talking to these people that she's interviewing. So she talks to her dad, she talks to the producer, and we really get a sense of their relationship, and we get her take on it, like her experience growing up with Chucky. So she is the daughter of Tony Gardner, who did the effects for the films. And so this has been a part of her life. So it's really interesting. I definitely would say it's quite sweet. My one criticism would be that the plot lines aren't interwoven. So we hear about the Chucky franchise and then she comes into the film. I would have much rather that she came into the film earlier when her father started working on the movies so that we could see her grow up with the films as they progressed. And instead of now, it's almost like two movies. Now we get the saga and then we get her. It's still quite good. And I would definitely say that if you're a fan, if you're a Chucky fan, if you're a horror fan, this is a love letter to those movies and a great guide. It's almost like a companion piece to the series. It's something of a historical document. If you're a behind-the-scenes nut or a horror fan, definitely recommend it. Highly recommend it. It's a must-see. It's Jason Godby for No Rest for the Weekend here with Danny Mendez once again from thecinebuff.com. We have seen another horror movie together, The Last Voyage of the Demeter, which comes out August 11th. So, Danny, for those who are unfamiliar, tell them what it's about.
So basically, it is a Dracula film. It's an excerpt from one of the logs in the book about the voyage of the Demeter, the crew members in the ship, and ultimately what happened aboard it.
I was curious to see the film. We actually reported about it. We did an episode that was kind of highlighting horror movies that came out this year and that were going to come out. And my biggest curiosity was, all right, so it's one chapter. It's like, it's a very short part of the Bram Stoker's Dracula novel.
How are they going to make it?
How is that a movie?
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing, and my curiosity was that, plus the curiosity of the fact that I do like vampire movies. I like Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. And even then, it mentions the Demeter as well in that movie.
In the book, I think it's just the captain's log.
Okay.
So I think all of these characters are kind of invented for the movie. And I like the characters. I like the look of the film. It had that gothic horror film to, mm-hmm. you know, horror feel to it, I don't watch a lot of horror movies, but that is one thing I do like. And I'm a big Dracula fan. I loved Bram Stoker's Dracula. I remember seeing that movie in the theater. And I thought this was an interesting take on that and the character. I like Liam Cunningham a lot. I like all the actors. I think there's some really good performances in the film.
I do like some. I don't think all the characters necessarily get all their time to develop in a way that I thought would have made for a stronger film, maybe a more dramatically potent film.
Yeah, even though it's 2 hours, it moves really fast.
It does. I think in my opinion, it takes a while in the first act to, you know, move along. But once the introduction of Dracula and everything that's going on aboard the ship starts to, you know, happen, I think it starts to really pick up steam and gets really interesting.
Yeah, I thought I liked the characters. I liked everybody in it. I thought the performances were solid. I thought the writing was good. Didn't seem like, you know, how horror movies can have that cheesy, clunky mm-hmm. writing sometimes. I thought the dialogue and everything was good. There was something a little bit missing, and it's hard. We've just seen it. We literally just came out. We're still in the theater, so it's hard to kind of put your finger on what that is. But we were talking just before we rolled that it reminded both of us of Alien.
Alien, and I would say The Thing too, just because it's a group of, I guess you could say, blue collar workers in a ship,
isolated.
Exactly, it has that real claustrophobia feel to it, which I really dug.
Yeah, and I really liked all the stuff with the ship. Like, I thought the ship looked really real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I couldn't tell what was practical and what was effects.
Right.
I thought all of the effects looked great. I thought the creature looked great.
Great creature design. Yep, yeah. I agree.
One thing, though, did you see the trailer for this?
Anytime I went to a movie theater, they would show the trailer, and it got my curiosity, so.
I only wish they hadn't revealed the creature design in the trailer.
I agree, and I also think they should have. Honestly, it would have been so much more fun if they just slowly showed bits and pieces of the creature throughout the movie until you get a big reveal, maybe near, not the end, but in the middle.
Sort of did that.
Sort of,
it was a slower creature reveal, but it didn't seem to have the impact they wanted it to have.
Exactly.
You know, I hate to say this about a movie, but I felt like all the ingredients were there, but something didn't quite gel for me. They wanted it to have a bigger, better impact than it ended up having. Like, there were big dramatic moments with, you know, the kills and so forth. But I think they wanted the deaths to have more impact.
Which I think would have worked with maybe stronger writing of the characters. I like the actors. I think they're good with the stuff that they're given. I just don't think the characters themselves in the film really, like, just like an Alien with Ripley and all the supporting characters, I think they all each have their own distinct personalities, and I didn't quite get that from this film.
Do you think maybe there's a 2.5 hour or 3 hour cut of this movie, and they cut out some of the character development?
I would hope so, and if so, I'd like to see that cut.
Me too, because you've got really good actors, you've got solid
Absolutely.
Writing... But, you know, maybe there's a studio note somewhere and said, hey, guys, this has got to be a 2-hour movie. You can't do this. You know, we can't do 2.5 or 3 hours. But, you know, maybe there is more to it, because I noticed that. So, you know, basically the movie is divided up into day and night. You know, and of course, you know, the Dracula is a vampire and he's
so
nocturnal.
So everything happens at night, and then the daytime is more character stuff.
But the daytime stuff, those days went really fast.
Yes. I think it's to make... Yeah, because I guess they're trying to get to the real meat of the story, which is basically what everybody's there for. They're just to watch Dracula
kill. Yeah, but I think you have a better movie if we spend more time...
Yes, I agree.
You mm-hmm. know, like...
Absolutely.
And maybe that's what it's missing. Maybe those daytime scenes at one point were more fleshed out and we had more character development.
I agree.
But they sort of, like, zip along, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, the movie moves. It's 2 hours, but it's paced quickly.
very quickly. I agree.
I also like the stuff in the beginning of the movie, the setup, where you have the gypsies who are bringing the crates of earth to the ship. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that seemed all really real. I love the production design. Cinematography was great.
Like, cinematography was actually really good.
And the creature design and the looks of all the characters, everything felt like really dirty and authentic. You know, like it did feel like you were on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that it was a little bit. It's hard to put your finger on, but the ingredients. But maybe we're onto something. Maybe there is like a longer cut of this movie with more character development,
which would have made this movie. I think it would have made it from what I classify essentially as a mid decent genre movie into something that could have been maybe a horror classic in the future. Who knows? I don't want to hyperbolize or anything like that, but there's a possibility.
It's hard to tell. You know, it's hard to, also, we've just seen it, so this is just our like initial gut reaction mm-hmm. to the movie. But, you know, I did enjoy it, you know, and I'm not a horror guy. Like, I don't run out to every horror film. We saw this courtesy, once again, of Brooklyn Horror Film Festival, which was, thank you guys, big shout out and a thanks to you. I guess the question is, would you recommend this one?
Probably on a home streaming service late at night, you know, your weekend at the house, just grab a popcorn or a snack and just enjoy it. I think it's best watched, you know, at home.
Yeah, I did like the look of it, so I would say, If you're a Dracula super fan, like if you're you love vampire movies and you really dig the Dracula story and you want to see this chapter of it, I think it was really well done, and I think it looked really good on a big screen.
It does look good. I won't deny that.
We saw it for free, so the question is this one worth actually paying to see? You think not?
Maybe at a dollar theater. Do they still have dollar theaters?
I thought it was great to come and see it in the theater.
I love going to the cinema for anything. If you like going to the theater, yes, go watch this in the theater. But if the general population who's, you know, being a little more frugal with their money, I suppose, just wait for it to stream.
Yeah, it's August right now, so, you know, the competition is these big summer blockbuster-type movies.
It's slowly winding down now that it's August. Everybody's going to start going back to school.
Yeah, August can be kind of a dumping ground for studios.
I think this, to be fair, though, this film is actually, to me, it's slightly better than the average August movie dump that you see.
Yeah, yeah.
It's serviceable.
Yeah, I think it's a good film. It's solid. There's a lot of good stuff in there. I maybe wish there was more of it. And, you know, maybe I think Danny's right. Maybe it's a stay home and stream it recommendation. I would definitely check it out, though. I definitely would recommend the movie.
If you have the opportunity to check it out, yes, absolutely go see it, whether it be at the theater and streaming or whatever. Just check it out. It's a fun horror movie. Some good kills.
Yeah,
good creature design.
I would say, who's it for? I would say any horror junkie.
Horror genre fans, yeah, absolutely.
If you're like a Dracula super fan, I think if you like films like Nosferatu, if you like Bram Stoker's Dracula, mm-hmm. you know, definitely see this one.
Especially Bram Stoker's Dracula. That one,
it's almost felt like a companion piece
yes,
to that.
Yes, I was going to say double feature. You can watch the Bram Stoker Dracula with this one. You'd have a lot of fun.
All right, so that's all for right now. We're at the AMC Theater in Times Square, and that was our brief reaction review of The Last Voyage of the Demeter. For more of our content, visit norestoftheweekendpodcast.com, and for more of Danny Mendez's review,
thecinebuff.com.
All right, thanks so much, and good night.
Good night.
Just to give people some background, the film takes place in Finland in 1944. This is basically the end of the war, the end of World War II. The Nazis know they're losing, so they decide to do a slash and burn. So we're out in the plains, I guess, of Finland in this place called Lapland, which is the middle of nowhere, which makes things really interesting. So I call this movie, I say it's like part spaghetti western, part Rambo, part John Wick, part Mad Max Fury Road, some ultra-violent anime throw it in there. And, you know, you kind of make that up into a meatball, give it a heart, and you get Sisu. I thought the hero, to me, he kind of looked like Bryan Cranston and Clint Eastwood had a middle-aged badass baby kind of thing. And he's so, like, rugged. He looks like he eats shrapnel for breakfast. There's so much action and carnage in this thing. You know, it's a perfect movie if you want to see some Nazis get, you know, exploded. Where its strength lies, it's incredibly simple. It's very straightforward. There are no subplots. It's like a galloping horse running in one direction. You know, it occasionally does stop to breathe, you know, so that, you know, our hero can pull some bullets and shrapnel out of himself. It's a game of this hide and seek, but because of the barren terrain, there's like no place to hide. One of the movies that the director referenced that was a big inspiration to him was Rambo First Blood. But in that movie, he's like in a forest, so he's got places to go and hide, and he has the advantage. But in this, it's like you've got tanks and a whole company of Nazis coming after you, and there's nowhere to go, which I thought just gave it not only a great plot element, but also gave it a beautiful look. I noticed that a lot of the scenes looked like they were shot at sunset, so they shot during golden and magic hour. We saw it at the Dolby 88, which has a great sound system. The sound design of this movie is tremendous. You hear all of this great stuff in it, and it gives us this real sense of realism, and that's juxtaposed by the score, which was used quite sparingly, I thought. It only comes in key moments, but it's this really sort of ethereal, haunting, almost like this supernatural element of a score.
It was a little eerie.
Yeah, it's like this really eerie kind of thing. I would say that the other big element, of course, was the graphic violence. Was this too violent for you?
No, honestly, I think that...
Because I know you're not a horror movie fan.
No, this was a lot of excitement. It was just, I think I was so excited that the horror part of it and the gore, it just went away because it was much needed, you know? It was much needed.
And it's a lot of fun, too. It's like, to me, it looked almost like, it reminded me of sort of an anime violence, like in an animated cartoon, like a Japanese anime. Or like something out of like a heavy metal comic.
Kill Bill. Yeah. More of a Kill Bill.
Lots of Tarantino in there. But it works. And there are times where they use the laughter and they use the violence to get laughs.
Yes.
There's a couple of great laughs in the movie where even though it's very serious in a lot of ways, you get these great moments of levity where – because it's just ridiculous. Like, the violence is so over the top at some points. I think my one sort of criticism of the movie is there are a few of these moments where you're like, why? Just shoot him. Why don't they just shoot him? Because they don't shoot him. And they have him dead to rights a couple of times.
Yes.
And there's a couple of times where he survives where you're like, okay, this guy has – why is he not dead? But they kind of explain it. He's almost like a superhero.
Yeah.
You know, he's got like almost like Wolverine powers kind of thing where he just like sort of regenerates. The other criticism is, so in this movie we've got our hero, this grizzled, silent, strong, silent type, literally like he never talks. And then we have the Nazis who are pursuing him. And then there is the Nazis have kidnapped these women that they're abusing, so which gave me the Mad Max Fury Road vibes. Mm-hmm. And there's like one sort of hero woman who talks, and the rest of them I don't think speak at all.
I don't think they had any lines.
And she gets some great stuff. Our hero lady does get some great stuff, but the rest of those characters really don't get any character development. They do a lot visually, though, where you do kind of see what's happened to them. Like, you can tell by the way they react, you can tell by the way they look, and you can also, you know, see it in their attitude. There's a lot of good silent acting.
Yes.
Actually, the most lines are the Nazis. You know, the Nazis, actually, they're bad guys, but they get, and they're very bad guys. Like,
you think?
Yeah, these are not your comic, you know, Nazis. These are not Mel Brooks Nazis.
He was heartless.
These are, you know, we're going to burn everything down, kill everybody. Kidnap some women and rape them Nazis.
Yes.
But they do get some decent development. You know, there's a point in the story where you're like, well, why are they doing this? Like, this guy is, you know, he's killed a bunch of their guys and what, you know, why are they? But it's like, well, you know, the war's ending.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have a lot of options. Let's get this guy's gold.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, the main standout is our hero, played by an actor called Jorma Tamila. And he's like I said, literally the strong silent type. Even though he doesn't really say anything in the film, he's doing so much because not only with his presence, but the stuff that they say about him, you know, has a lot. And he's got this big dilemma. So he's got 500 and something miles to go to a city, and everything in between the middle of nowhere where he's prospecting and where he needs to get to is just nothingness. I don't know exactly where they shot it, because I don't know Finland geography, but they did have some great, from what sets they did have some great stuff, like these burnt down towns and things like that. And some, you know, some really great special effects, great over-the-top stunts. One question is, I would say, like, who is this movie for? You know, I always ask, like, you know, if you recommend a movie, who is it for? I would say not for the faint of heart. If you can't laugh at ridiculous violence, then this, like, if you take this too seriously, it's not going to be for you, because the action is very strong. It's over the top. And, you know, I even asked him about the rating, and it, like, this is a hard R. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no sex in the movie. There's no real nudity or anything, except for, I think you see that guy naked, but...
No, he was half. He put on his suspenders.
Right.
It was just to make you know what was happening to the girls in the truck.
Right, so you but you never see
but
any of that
see,
stuff.
Right, you don't see
the,
it.
The main part of it is the violence.
Yes.
So if you can't deal with violence, this is not for you. If you are... I find it almost refreshing now to see a real rated R movie in a theater, because everything is like PG-13 now.
Yes.
But so if you like action, if you don't mind violence, if you can laugh when it gets utterly ridiculous and suspend your disbelief, highly recommend the movie. Dollyland, it's directed by Mary Harron. I don't know if you know her, but she directed American Psycho. And this stars Sir Ben Kingsley as Salvador Dali. Now, I can't really go into detail because there's an embargo date, and this is going to air before the embargo date, but I'll give you like a brief review. So this is a biopic of the surrealist artist Salvador Dali. Dali is seen through the eyes of a young man played by Christopher Brinney, who is assisting him before this big show in New York during the 1970s. He's got this real 70s flair to it. Kingsley was... he's Ben Kingsley, so he's amazing. As Salvador Dali, has a stellar supporting cast, including Barbara Sakawa, who plays this woman called Gala, who is his life/business partner. She, like, manages his estate, manages his affairs. It's a really good-looking film, really beautiful cinematography. This is Dali at the end of his life, you know, so it's old. He's an old man at this point, and he's kind of losing it here and there. Can't go into too many details. All I can say is I definitely recommend it, especially if you're into artist biopics. Dollyland will open in theaters here June 6th. Showing Up, starring Michelle Williams, directed by Kelly Reinhart, I think is how you say her name. They have worked together before. It's sort of a dramedy about this woman. She's a sculptor. She kind of works at this artist commune kind of place, and she's gearing up for an art show. And it's kind of a very slice of life kind of movie. Michelle Williams, of course, is very good in it. She's wonderful in everything. I saw her on Broadway. She's an amazing actor. And it's well-directed. It's well-acted. Everybody's very good in the film. We see the conflicts that she has with her mother, the relationship with her dad, with her brother, and her landlord. She has, like, a conflict with her landlord. At one point, she discovers this bird in her house. A pigeon has gotten to her house, and her cat's attempting to murder it. And she rescues the pigeon and kind of like sends it out the window, and then the next day the landlord finds it, and she's like, oh, look, I found this wounded bird, and I'm nursing it back to health. And together through the film, they sort of nurse the bird back to health, and that's kind of funny. There's a few genuine, like, chuckles in the film, but it's one of those movies that it kind of reminded me of like a 90s era Jim Jarmusch-y kind of film, where the protagonist sort of bumps into other people, but nothing much really happens in the movie. There didn't seem to be any big character arc. There doesn't seem to be any huge denouement. There doesn't seem to be any movie in this movie. But I know some people will probably dig it just because of the way it portrays these people, you know, and this sort of life. And it is kind of fun, but I just found myself at the end going, why? You know, like, I feel like I'm just hanging out with these people. You know, I'm like, I wanted more movie in my movie, basically. But that being said, performances are really strong, very, very well directed. The camera moves only when it needs to, and it's very, very precise. This, you know, you can tell the director she knew what she wanted. And it's well done, but I just kind of wondered, what's the point of this? Like, why are we watching this? But
one quick question that I'm sure is on everybody's mind. Is Michelle Williams playing a mother in this movie?
She's not playing a mom. She's playing.
Okay, that makes like five total for her career.
So she's playing a woman who she's like single. She doesn't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend or anything like that. She lives alone, and it's kind of a lonely portrait. And I guess what they're trying to say with the film is that she sort of finds something in the relationship she has, sort of bringing this bird back into health. You know, but
so she's mothering the bird. Okay,
she's a little. It's a little nurturing happening with the bird. So you could say she's a bird mom.
I'm not trying to be mean spirited, but it is hilarious to me that like literally 90% of the roles that Michelle Williams has had as an adult is her being some sort of sainted mother. I was like, she's a fantastic actress. I love her to death, but holy crap, a typecast.
Yeah, she. I mean, she was. I saw her in, I believe it was Blackbird on Broadway, and she was wonderful. Like, she's great, you know. But
she's fantastic. But I just love it when she gets to do more than just that.
Yeah, I just, you know, if you're gonna watch this movie, don't expect anything big to happen. You know, like, don't expect the big climax because you will be sorely disappointed. Across the Spider-Verse was my top. I saw that in the theater. I did not see the previous film in the theater, so I really wanted to see this one in the theater, and it did not disappoint. It is a lot of movie. It picks up right where the first chapter left off, and we continue the story of Miles Morales. A lot of it is Gwen Stacy's film, and she gets a lot of character development. We also get a lot of weird and wonderful worlds of Spider-Man. My only criticism would be that at times it was a bit overwhelming. Like, at times I was like I didn't write a review for it because I feel like I need to see it at least two or three times before I can really write anything about it. And I just didn't get a chance to go back to the theater. It's difficult to grade because it's not the end of, we don't get the end of the story yet. It ends on a dot, dot, dot. So it's hard to say because it doesn't feel like a complete movie yet. Yeah, because it ends on a cliffhanger. But other than that, I thought it was amazing. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 was, I didn't expect it. I had heard a lot about it. I had seen a couple of reviews, finally saw it, and I thought, wow, this, first of all, it's a lot of movie. I think it was a really fitting ending to the trilogy, and it really did it like as a chapter of their story, of these misfit superhero story. I thought it ended on a great note. All the stuff, one of the things I thought was the most amazing thing about it, a lot of it concerns the Rocket character, and it's, you see a lot of his backstory, how he was made, his tragic beginning. It's very sad, and if you're, you know, I wouldn't show a kid this movie. Like, if you have a kid who, especially if they love animals, there's a lot of like animal cruelty and stuff in it. And it's very emotional. And the thing I kept having to tell myself was, it's a CGI character. Like, it's a CGI character. They're getting all of this emotion out of a computer generated image. I was just blown away by that. But James Gunn did it great. It's nice for him to leave on a high note, leaving Marvel, going on to DC. We'll see what he does there. But I thought it was great. I thought it was really solid. And I haven't really been all that crazy about what the MCU has been offering. And this was a high point for it.
We're starting right at the top. My favorite film of the summer so far, I have to say, Barbie. Who knew? I wasn't expecting to like this movie at all, but I totally loved it. And why? Because it's just fun. It's the funnest movie I've seen for a long time, and it's perfect for summer. And it has a great message, but mostly it's just fun. And it's really funny too. All kinds of jokes, all kinds of Easter eggs, all kinds of cameos. It's just fun from beginning to end. The clothes are fabulous. The sets are fabulous. Everything about it is fabulous.
What was it about it that kind of put it over the edge for you?
A couple of really good performances. First of all, Margot Robbie as stereotypical Barbie. She plays it just right with such sincerity, and yet it's so absurd. And later on in the film, when she starts to learn about herself and about the real world, She's totally convincing. I love the moment when she sits down to an elderly woman at a bus stop and she takes a look at her. She's never seen anyone who's old before. And she looks at her and she says so sincerely, "You're beautiful." And it just is such a touching moment to me. The older woman says, "I know," which is a great answer. She's played by an Oscar-winning costume designer, by the way. And so you've got the combination of the fun stuff plus a little bit of the feels too. And like I said, a great message about how equality is best for everyone.
My top for the year so far is the other half of this equation, Oppenheimer. Nothing against Barbie. I absolutely loved it, especially Kate McKinnon as Weird Barbie and the soundtrack. Really good stuff there. Lots of fun. But Oppenheimer, like, is the first true Best Picture contender I've seen so far this year. Nolan's cinematic eye has never been better. Cillian Murphy's performance is nomination worthy, as is Robert Downey Jr. like as Louis Strauss. I'm looking forward to 10 years down the road, like, having debates between this Chaplin and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang as his best role. Very strong supporting cast: Emily Blunt, Josh Hartnett, Casey Affleck, Rami Malek, and my man Matt Damon here, and of course Florence Pugh, making me swoon more than I should for a married man in his 30s. But I'm a single guy in my 40s, so it's okay. The plot structure is really strong, and this is what Nolan, this is his stock and trade of just kind of messing with timelines. The way he basically splits the story up into two parts, one being in color for everything leading up to the bomb, and then one in black and white for everything that happens after it. It's a really great visual metaphor of the promise of scientific discovery and study and exploration, and then the black and white, very binary consequences once the trigger is pulled. It's absolutely masterful. There's not a single element that rings false. I didn't even get the least bit bored with this being a three-hour movie. I mean, I guess mild spoiler, they detonate the bomb 2 hours in. I'm thinking, what are they going to do for the last hour of this? And they filled it brilliantly. Not once did it drag.
I guess we have to include Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. It's a ludicrous plot. Let's just say that. But the action sequences, the stunts, the car chase, which isn't only a great car chase, but is also humorous. You know, I mean, it's a summer popcorn movie. What can you say? Hayley Atwell is a nice addition. She does a good job. Like I said, the plot is kind of ludicrous. It's an AI creature almost. It's a program which has become so smart that it's become self-aware and is starting to take over programs of everything in the world and will control the world. And the only thing that can stop it is a physical key. Now, why a physical key would be needed to stop what's essentially a computer program, I don't know. But that's the MacGuffin. That's what sets them all off chasing all over the world to find the key. So whatever. But anyway, the stunts are great.
You know, when I saw that the plot was like a rogue AI, I was like, oh, this is obviously written by a Writers Guild writer.
But then we have Talk to Me, A24 horror movie from Australia, directed by twin brothers Danny and Michael Philippou. They run a YouTube channel basically about horror and comedy. And this is one of the more disturbing horror films I've seen in recent memory. Like it's up there with Get Out as far as like the actual quality of the writing and the idea of using an inherently flimsy horror device to tell a much more important story. It's like Get Out used this idea of, you know, brain transplants basically to tell a story about black erasure. Talk to Me uses literally a mummified hand that you play with like a Ouija board, you know, and talk to ghosts, basically as a sheen to talk about mental health and suicide and crippling loneliness. It's amazing what this young cast of no-names, like literally Miranda Otto from Lord of the Rings plays one of the characters' mothers, and she's the only recognizable name in that cast, how they basically treat this ability to speak to the dead as a designer drug. Elements of peer pressure and coping mechanisms, it all flows together so well. And then just for good measure, because you're talking a budget of about $4 million here, the Philippou brothers use some really strong makeup, practical effects, and camera techniques to really shock you with the scares when they come. The opening sequence alone, as this brilliant one take, is it sets the tone for everything because it shows off their filmmaking skills and finds a way to just drop your jaw when it finally hits its crescendo. Everything in the movie is meant to live up to that, and it does.
My next movie that neither of you have mentioned yet is Asteroid City, which is the Wes Anderson movie. Now, he's an acquired taste, I admit, but if you like Wes Anderson, you'll love this movie. I think this was much better than his last one. But he uses the device again of a story within a story within a story. It was a little confusing, I know, to some people in the audience that I saw it with, but if you manage to keep it straight, it's fine. And really, you have to look beneath all of the very square camera shots and everything to realize that this is really a movie about grief. The main character, Jason Schwartzman's character, his wife has just died. And although he's not overt in his grief, the grief is there. The grief is there with his children, who he hasn't told yet. The grief is there in other characters for other things. And so it makes a nice counterpoint to all of the bright colors and everything. It's a movie that you have to think about a little bit, but it's also fun. It has funny moments and fun moments, and just totally absorbing. I loved it. And cameos by everybody.
Now, did you see French Dispatch?
Yes.
The one I thought that movie felt like he was sort of parodying himself a little bit.
It went almost a little bit too far, and that's why I liked this one better. This one harkens back in feeling a little bit more to some of the earlier ones. So while he used some of the same device of, you know, like he did in French Dispatch, the story within the story within the story type thing, it was more appealing, much more appealing.
Next for me, basically my, in essence, hidden gem movie for the summer, Theater Camp. Absolute joy, especially for someone like me who was a theater nerd in high school. This is hopefully just going to be your, you know, little movie that could just absolute delight. Based on a short film that Molly Gordon and Nick Lieberman, Ben Platt, all these, you know, well-known theater, film, comedy people have done, you know, they did the short a few years ago. They adapted into a feature length. Really stellar cast of both adults and children, kind of parodying the manic nature of theater as an art form and as a hobby. But it's also this kind of fun story about, you know, these are kids. This is the one opportunity they have to basically own the spotlight and be in the majority as their own selves for once, rather than, you know, potentially being ostracized or left in the corner. And they make the most of it. As one of the characters says, you know, these are theater kids. They turn cardboard into gold. And the way this mockumentary style in the best traditions of Christopher Guest does is basically like show over the course of 4 weeks in almost slapstick funny fashion how these kids can pull it all together, how the adults are more childish than the children. Absolutely just everything a kid like me who was, you know, part of this group would have wanted. And again, absolutely fun cast. Like I said, Molly Gordon, Ben Platt, Patty Harrison, she's absolutely great. Amy Sedaris has a fun small role. Alan Kim from Minari, he was the littlest one in Minari. He's in this movie as an aspiring agent. Like, so he spends the whole camp experience on the phone trying to book gigs for the other campers. It's just so twisted. I love it.
I also loved Theater Camp. And I hope it finds an audience, because I'm afraid that the audience may be a little limited due to the nature of all the in-jokes in the movie. But it is great fun. And I have to admit, brought a tear to my eye at the end. No tear stick needed.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, the song. How did it work? It worked. How did it work?
The lyrics were terrible.
It was so awful, but it was perfect.
Thank you.
So one of the first films that I saw for the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival was Booger. So that one's directed by Mary Doderman. It's mainly about one character, her played by Grace Glowicki. So her character just recently experienced the loss of one of her closest friends and her roommate. So the film kind of, it's about her coming to terms with that grief. And that grief is personified in a black cat whose name is the title of the film, Booger. So what I was really drawn to from the film is that it's very claustrophobic, very atmospheric. It's not scary by traditional horror terms, but I think where it's more effective during moments of experiencing the character's trauma, her coming to terms with that grief that she's experiencing. And there's actually quite a few moments of body horror. So if you're into that, or if you're disgusted by that, it's there. There's some of that. It's not shock horror, jump scare horror, anything like that. It's basically an observation or a character study into this character as she slowly mentally unravels as the film goes on. I thought it was really strong. Very good character performance from the main actress, Grace Glowicki. Strong emotional center. And yeah, I just really also like the way that the film is paced. It has a deliberate pace to it, but it allows the sort of tension of the film to play out to its, you know, very meaningful conclusion. Really dug this one. Thought it was a great performance. And yeah, not scary in the traditional sense, but a lot of stuff to unpack psychologically, which really gets under your skin. It is actually darkly humorous in a way. There's quite a few moments where it is funny. So it's not scary, scary, scary the whole time. So you can get a couple laughs out of there too. So it gives it a good kind of personality.
The first film that I watched was called Breathing In. It's a South African film from director Hako Bauer. When I got the list and I was looking through all the possibilities, I front-loaded foreign horror films. I find foreign horror films often can take us to places that American audiences aren't quite ready to go to yet. So I started with a South African horror film. This is based on a stage play by Reza Dewet called Breathing In as well. As it was a stage play, it mostly takes place in one area. But once you translate that to film, you often have to vary that location so that things don't get boring. What I really liked that Hako Bauer did was he explored the space outside of the main setting, in this case, a small cabin in the middle of war-torn country, by basically elevating the darkness. So you'll see terrifying eyes poking out of the darkness. You'll see things that make your skin crawl that push you back into the house. And so it was a great way to say, there's nothing for you out there. Focus on this story here. As the story was set behind the Anglo-Boer War, you would think that it would be a greater commentary on conquest and conflict. But really, it's a matriarchal story about the bonds between a mother and daughter and the evil that men do. It's very much a feminine tale, and that the men are cast in a negative light as they busy themselves with their tiny little distractions of war. The performances are fantastic, and I really want to call out the score by Pierre-Henri Wicombe. It's very evocative, lots of long, tense strings to really just play the emotion out as the film went on. So kudos to this movie. I don't think it's going to get a great cult following, but from a technical standpoint, very good film.
I'm always surprised when I see like some foreign films, because often you don't know the actors, so you just really see them as that character. And it's even more suspenseful. It's even more frightening because you don't have to suspend your disbelief as much because it's a movie star that you recognize, kind of thing.
I would very much agree with that. And I will say to those who are frightened of foreign films, this film is filmed in English because it takes place in South Africa, so all the characters spoke English. So it is accessible.
Blackout. So the director, Larry Fessenden. So this is his take on a werewolf movie. What I find interesting about most horror films is that it takes some of those tropes, the horror tropes and the monsters, and they have some sort of allegorical meaning to them. So this one with Blackout, it has a lot of things going on, a lot of things on its mind. So it's a film about class struggles, demons within, personal demons within people, alcoholism, I guess you could say, because that is a theme in the film itself as well. I don't think it necessarily tackles all its themes flawlessly. It's a little clumsy in that regard. But I do think where it really excels is in the main character, Charlie, who's played by Alex Hurt. So basically, he's a local painter. And he also, during the full moon, he turns into a werewolf. But I don't think that the werewolf concept is the main focus, because this character is really, he's complex. He has a lot of things going on. He has an alcohol addiction problem. He has a ton of different things going on in his mind. And it's just him trying to come to terms with the physical beast of the werewolf, as well as the battling of his own complex mind and his sort of fears and alcoholism. And I thought that was where the film really excelled. That's where the film is at its strongest. And that's where, gladly, most of the film's attention is on him and his story. All the other things about class struggle, while clumsy, it's still fairly entertaining. Very gruesome. There's a lot of solid gore and blood effects. And I just thought the performance itself was the glue that held this whole thing together.
With a werewolf story, you always got to talk about the creature, because you've seen greatness, you know, like you've seen like American Werewolf in London.
That's what came to mind.
Yeah, and then you see ones where they look like bears, you know, like give me like a scale of 1 to 10, rate the creature for me.
Oh man, I gotta say it's actually a solid 8. So the film to me, it feels like it does feel small budget, but I do think that the costume design for the werewolf itself is actually really well done. It's scary. It looks real. It's solid. And I like the way. So I know this director, he did another film called Depraved, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm really curious to see it, because he takes the Frankenstein monster and he modernizes it in Brooklyn, basically. So my interest in this film as well, because he takes that concept of the werewolf and puts it in a modern setting and sets it in modern themes and stuff like that. So it's a great modern take on the werewolf story.
And are we talking CGI werewolf or
no? Like it's dude in literally a suit, practical effects. Yeah, in a suit. It looks phenomenal. It's a pretty strong recommendation for me based on that alone. You don't see the werewolf often. It's much more of a character drama, so it's focused on Alex's character in human form. But when the werewolf does come out, it's actually pretty terrifying, and it looks great.
I actually just saw someone talk about the werewolf movie that Benicio del Toro was in about 10 years ago, and that sort of being like an underrated movie. And lots of people have attempted it. Most of them fail. And then when you see like bad CGI werewolf, it's just, you know, like the acting can be top notch and that just ruins the film. But I think people are getting back to the guy in a suit type of thing.
It just looks better.
Yeah. I remember we saw Last Voyage of the Demeter.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was some good suit stuff going on there, good makeup. And I'm sure there was CGI in there as well. But that creature design really sold it for me.
But that's where I like when you mix practical with CGI, because I think both can work together. You just have to, it's like meet me halfway, basically. I don't think one works without the other. I mean, some good costume can work without CGI, but with CGI, it only enhances the realism, I guess. It makes it more believable.
Property, or that's the English translation, by Brazilian filmmaker Daniel Bandeira. He wrote and directed this feature, and it's essentially a tale of class struggle. It takes place on a farm where indentured servants live on the farm. They live there, they work there, they raise their families there, they do their shopping through their superintendent there. So they're very dependent on this land. This land is their home. And the owners of the farm are planning to sell it and turn it into fancy high-rise hotels. And so the people who work on the farm desperately need to get their affairs in order quickly, get their papers that are held in the safe so that they must continue to work there. They're essentially held hostage on the farm by their working relationship. And so in an effort to free themselves, violence breaks out. It's an interesting tale about the fine line between poverty and desperation. I will say this film isn't entirely that sociopolitical. However, it does deal with class struggle and caste systems. There's a deep layer of PTSD underneath because the film opens with viral camera footage of an assailant holding a woman hostage in a face-off with police. The police shoot the assailant dead, and you hear the crowd that has been watching this unfold erupt in applause. And it sets that precedent then that the bad guy being punished is good. Then as the film takes off, you realize that the main character, Teresa, played by Malu Gaye, is that woman. And she finds herself in a standoff with the farm workers. And what's interesting about the film is that no one begins the film as evil, but no one ends the film as good. It's very bleak. It's very brutal. I think people who like that heavy sociopolitical message, who like that tension and who like that bleak brutality in their horror films will really flock to this one. It was technically superior, and I think it's going to get a lot of horror fans talking.
Okay, I got questions. So wait, you said there was like viral. Does this place take place now?
It does take place in the current time. In fact, the vehicle that they're in appears to be, so most of the film takes place, Teresa barricades herself inside an armored SUV that the family has purchased because of their affluence. Her husband, Walter, played by Carlos Amarin, is clearly infatuated with his own wealth and uses it as an armor around him, both metaphysically and literally, in the sense that he buys this armored SUV. So the glass is bulletproof. No one can get in from the outside. She barricades herself inside this Dodge SUV. So it's hyper modern, which is going to open eyes because some people don't know that there are still people living that way in the world we live in right now in 2023 or 2022 when this film actually came out in Brazil.
Yeah, that was like, there are indentured servants now? Like, is that what they're called, or is that just kind of practically what they are?
It's what they are in reality, but not in name.
Okay, so it's a sort of a modern-day indentured servitude kind of thing.
In Brazil, yes.
It's probably not something that I would rush out to go see, but do you think this is like, do you think this is going to be like a Brazilian submission for the Oscars or to get awards and things like that?
The acting is top-notch. The effects, the sound design, and the message. So yes, I could see this being an Oscar contender for its technical achievements, and again for its emotional story and its sociopolitical undertones. It's Lord of the Flies on a farm with, you know, the rich versus the poor. Unfortunately,
it doesn't really sound like a horror film, though. Like, would you think it's a horror film?
So I will say the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival does play fast and loose with the horror genre, but the beauty of the horror genre is that there are so many opportunities to tell different stories that would push the limits of what someone sitting down for a drama could take. For someone sitting down for a comedy would not expect to happen in that film. So then when you go into thrillers, you go into suspense, and you go into these artful deconstructions of civility, you kind of cross into horror territory.
I think a lot of people market their films as horror because there's like such a horror fan base, and you know, they think it's going to mean box office dollars, but I don't know if horror fans would go for something like that, even though it sounds like a really good movie. You know, like it'll be interesting. I mean, the Nightmare on Elm Street, Scream 6 crowd doesn't sound like that same kind of audience.
I will say the beauty of property and the beauty of some of the selections in the Brooklyn Horror Film Festival is that not all horror is monsters. Oftentimes the monsters are ourselves. So when you get these home invasion thrillers, these class uprisal thrillers, you cross into that horror territory when really it's like Last House on the Left is just a revenge thriller. But the kills are so intense that it crosses into horror. And again, it's about what your audience is comfortable with.
Oh, which stars Saoirse Ronan and Paul Mescal. It's set in 2065. It does have to deal with agriculture. Basically, these people, this young couple lives on a farm, and in 2065, the earth is dying. And it's dying, but it's really beautifully shot. So it's kind of like Mad Max meets Terrence Malick. So Ronan and Mescal, they're a young couple. They're living in this farm in the middle of nowhere. And this guy approaches from some government-y type office played by Aaron Pierce. And he basically disrupts their lives when he comes in to draft Paul Mescal's character to work on this space station that they're building. Gives me kind of like Elysium vibes, but we never see it. So it's sort of the thing in the sky. It's actually hard to review this movie because I don't want to get into spoilers. It's one of those movies, it's not about what you think it's about. And it has a lot to do, it's basically, it's like set in this sci-fi future, which seems very plausible, scarily enough, but it's really a character-driven drama. Like all good sci-fi, it really kind of is about exploring human relationships, human nature, explores the nature of love, explores the nature of commitment. I thought it was really interesting. I don't know how well this picture is going to do in terms of like box office and stuff, but because there's a name in it that they'll get some sort of release, but really strong acting, very strong writing, really well shot, well directed. Garth Davis is the director, and I'm kind of curious actually to see what this does. But at worst it's kind of a long episode of like a Black Mirror, but it's really kind of, it's like an indie sci-fi picture. Ferrari, directed by Michael Mann, starring Adam Driver, Penelope Cruz, and Shailene Woodley. And the first thing I thought about Ferrari was, it's good because of what it doesn't do. It doesn't try to distill a guy's life into 2 hours. It's just a particular time in Ferrari's life. So Enzo Ferrari, as many people know, he was the guy who invented the Ferrari cars, but he was also a race car driver before that. This film takes place in the late 1950s. He's sort of at a crossroads in his life. He's having trouble with his business. He's been told by his accountant his business is failing, and he needs to bring in more money. He needs to bring in a business partner if he's going to survive. And because he's basically been making more race cars than he should, he needs to make more production cars that he can sell to support the race car business. And he has a racing team called Team Ferrari. The accountant surmises that, okay, so Team Ferrari's got to win this big cross-country race, basically like a cross-country race across Italy. And he thinks if they win that, they'll get the attention they need to draw in somebody like a Ford or a Fiat to help subsidize Ferrari and partner with him. Now, in the meantime, he's also in sort of the final stages of his marriage to his wife, Laura, who's played by Penelope Cruz. They had a son that tragically died of an illness. So now they've kind of like fallen out of love, but they're still business partners. So it's very tangled up. And Woodley is his mistress and the mother of another son, a bastard son. And Ferrari also, in addition to going through all this business stuff, must decide whether or not he's going to give the child the Ferrari name. And Driver, of course, is very, and Cruz, they're both very strong. Driver is very stoic in the role, which I think in the hands of a lesser actor would come off sort of bland and not exciting. But the moments of emotion that we get out of him are great. And they're done very, very subtly. Cruz has the more showy role. Juxtaposed with all this character stuff, you have race car driving. You have these guys driving, 150 miles an hour around these test tracks. And you've got these guys in the cross-country race, which is sort of like your big climax. And then there are some horrific accidents in it as well, where cars just, and these cars are like, to look at them, nobody would race in these things. Like, first of all, they're convertibles. So it's just like you're in an open car with your head sticking out. All the drivers are wearing helmets and goggles, and they're driving really fast. If this thing flips over, you're just dead. Like anybody gets an accident, these things, you know, they're a headstone. It's really exciting, and Mann captures it really well. It's a shame that Mann doesn't get these fall release, critically acclaimed type movies enough. Yeah, because he's a wonderful director, and he's a wonderful director of actors, and he gets great, great performances. So I would definitely recommend that one. And actually, I think all of these are recommendations for me. I definitely would, definitely check them out. And, if you're wondering what's going to get nominated, what you're going to see again in March with little gold statuettes, these are probably all in contention. Maestro, it's a biopic about Leonard Bernstein, directed and starring Bradley Cooper as Bernstein, with Carey Mulligan as his wife, Felicia. The thing that's difficult about this movie is all of the elements are great. Like, the cinematography is amazing. Matthew LaBoutique shot this. He should probably get the Oscar. Production design, makeup, costumes, all of the elements of it are there. There are some strong performances. Sarah Silverman actually is in it, and she gives a good performance. And Carey Mulligan has never, I've never heard her hit a wrong note. She's just fantastic. The problem that lies with the movie is in the fact that it's less a movie and more like weaponized Oscar bait. It's as if the film was carefully constructed to win critics over and win awards. This is Bradley Cooper swinging for the fences and really trying to hit one out of the park. And it's like he saw Citizen Kane and said, I'm going to make my Citizen Kane. This is going to be my movie to end all movies. This is going to be what I'm known for. And I'm going to put this great piece of art up and everyone will praise it. And unfortunately, like I said, all of the elements are great. But the biggest thing is that you don't really get emotionally involved with the characters. At no time did I really like feel for the people, even though it's not like the actors are doing a bad job, but maybe it's in the writing, but it just doesn't feel like you can't, the pathos isn't there, the empathy isn't there. And I just felt like the whole time this movie had me by the back of the neck and was making me look at it and going, praise me, give me awards, that's what we're here for. And it took me completely out of the film. And I know some critics are going to love it. I know they're going to say, they're going to look at all the elements and say, this is brilliant. And I know some critics are going to feel like I do and feel like this is a total Oscar craving production. And, like, why are we doing this kind of thing? I do admire people when they take a big swing, but I feel like it's a swing and a miss. And I don't fault people for trying, but man, that was just hard. It was just a hard, hard one to watch. I will say, if you want to see a better version, I think a better version of this type of story, check out The Lovely, directed by Erwin Winkler and starring Kevin Klein and Ashley Judd. It's basically the same movie. Music, it's about Cole Porter. The Lovely covers a lot of the same ground and does it better in a more entertaining way. It is quite showy and theatrical in places, but not so forced.
The Promised Land, this is Denmark's official entry for the Oscar for International Feature, and they have a pretty good history there. They won with another round about 3 years ago. They were nominated for The Hunt back in 2012, and both of those films starred Mads Mikkelsen, as does this one. So they're going with what works, basically. So this is set in the 17th century, and it's based on a novel. Basically, Mikkelsen is the bastard son of a landowner of noble title or whatever, who basically just denied his existence. In fact, the Danish name for the movie is just Bastard. In spite of that, he worked really hard and rose up to the rank of captain in the military in an attempt to basically earn the nobility that he couldn't get by birthright. He solicits the crown to say, hey, this untamed heathland in the Jutland region that no one's been able to cultivate, I can do it. And he wants to build a settlement in exchange for an actual noble rank. They're like, sure, go ahead. You're going to fail like everybody else. Turns out he actually knows what he's doing and he's making progress. And that really ticks off this guy named Frederick DeShinkel, played absolutely brilliantly slimy by this guy named Simon Beneberg. He's the judge of the county. He's the nobleman. And he basically says, no, this land is mine and it's always been mine. I don't care what the government says. I own everything and you work for me. The back and forth they have of the class warfare, basically, as DeShinkel tries to assert and dominate through property and wealth rather than any kind of actual legal authority, makes for a really great dynamic. And then you have some really fun side stories about, you know, love affairs. There's a bit where Nicholson's character is in love with the woman who's engaged to DeShinkel, but she hates him. So it's like, hey, here's another nobleman I can marry if he gets his title. This is a way out for me. You also have the more salt of the earth Anne Barbara, who she was what they call a tenant worker, but it's basically a slave. She and her husband worked for DeShinkel and fled because he was a cruel master. End up working for Mickelson. The husband dies, so now she becomes an option because she's the one willing to actually put forth the work to have any kind of social mobility. And then the third way through this is you have these nomadic people that are called the Taters or the Tartars. They call them Taters in the film, but basically Turkic nomads who live in the woods, and they're not allowed to work. But basically Mickelson ends up adopting one of them. There's this whole overarching message of, you know, to coin the cliche, the friends we made along the way, but it's really, you thought you had this straightforward path to your dreams, and not only did it not turn out that way, just reality dictating different circumstances, there is a lot of worthwhile things, blessings, adventures to have on the periphery of that if you allow yourself to deviate from the path. And Nicholson just gives an absolutely brilliant performance, that perfectly subdued, dignified, stoic, and yet still deeply emotional just through his face type of performance. He's one of the few actors in the world who can pull this off every time he tries it. And he does it again brilliantly here. I would not be surprised if Denmark hears its name called again, either with the shortlist or the nominations when it's all said and done. They really, again, they're just doing what works. Like, give me a film, give me Mads Mikkelsen, question mark, profit. Teacher's Lounge. This is Germany's entry. Germany won the category this year with their remake of All Quiet on the Western Front, which, like, swept the BAFTAs and everything like that. It was a legitimate Best Picture contender. But now this is a much more intimate story, but kind of has the same themes, like this whole idea that conflict is pointless and there's only just collateral damage and people getting hurt. So you have Leonie Benesch, who I've not seen in anything else, but she stars as Carla Novak, and she's an elementary school teacher. And the film begins with basically a scandal going on. There's been a string of thefts from the teachers, like people stealing money. The teachers suspect one of the students. They don't know which one, but it's got to be a student, basically. They're going about their investigation in all the wrong ways, using intimidation techniques, racial profiling. It's not good. Carla basically decides, maybe I can catch someone in the act. She sticks some money in her sweater, hangs it on the back of her chair and in the teacher's lounge, and then leaves the webcam on her computer on. And sure enough, someone does take the money. It looks like it's one of the members of the staff. In good faith, she tries to get the money back from who she thinks did it, then reports it to the principals, and all hell breaks loose. Everything spirals out of control because technically what she did, recording without consent, was illegal. The accused is the mother of one of the students, one of her best students. She's a math teacher, and this kid is clearly her smartest pupil. Before long, basically everything comes back on her. Like, the fact that she's the only actual victim of a crime here is completely forgotten by the 30-minute mark. The faculty turns on her, and they were never really on her side in the first place. She's a new teacher, and they try to bully her into doing things their way, whether it's, you know, according to the law and the rules or not. And then she gets an outright revolt from the parents and the students. There's a lot of really solid tension and mystery in what's going on, what's going to happen next. I mean, by the time one of her students interviews her for the school paper in the most innocent manner possible, and it turns into the tabloid event of the year, everything is completely out of control. And there really is no positive way that this can turn out for everybody involved. And I think if you focus on the fact that, again, this is about highlighting the pointlessness of the conflict itself rather than who's right and who's wrong, you're really going to enjoy it. The ending didn't do much for me, and I'm not going to spoil it, but just think of the concepts of European movies and endings in general, and you'll kind of figure out already where I'm going with this. There's just so much there that you needed to stick the landing, and they just didn't quite get there on that for me, but still, well worth the ride. American Fiction, written and directed by Cord Jefferson. This is his feature debut, but he's a well-known TV writer. He's worked on Watchmen, Succession, Master of None, The Good Place, all really well-written shows. And his skill is on full display with this script. It's a biting, ripping satire of pandering to demographics. You know, well-meaning people that do it, but it's still disingenuous. In this case, we're talking about African-Americans in society. Jeffrey Wright stars as Thelonious Ellison, who of course is nicknamed Monk. He's a novelist and a literature professor, but he can't get his latest book sold. The publishers are all like, well, yeah, you're a black writer, but your writing's not black enough. He sees kind of a one-sided adversary in this woman named Centaurra Golden, played by Issa Rae. She's also a very well-educated writer, but she has struck it rich because she wrote a book about life in the ghetto, and it's something absurdly titled like, Is We Not Getting Out the Ghetto Now? You know, like, just very Ebonics-laced. One of the opening scenes, like watching her give a dramatic reading as someone who's lived on the bottom rung of society, even though she herself is an Oberlin-educated literati, is something to behold. The whole crux of the story is, in between being ostracized at work, having his creativity stifled, and a whole lot of family drama back home in Boston, one night Monk decides, screw it, I'm going to write one of these pandering ghetto books myself under the pseudonym Stag R. Lee, which is just brilliant on its face. And of course, it's an overnight sensation, and now he has to craft this entire character around this writer to try to pass off this book just to get it sold. He thinks it's a joke. He's trying to rub it in people's faces that this is not what you're supposed to be latching onto, and yet the more he does, the more people want to give him money for this complete hoax of an experiment. And it's amazing to watch. Jeffrey Wright definitely deserves a Best Actor nomination for this, as does the screenplay. And you've got a really strong supporting cast with Tracy Ellis Ross, Sterling K. Brown, Leslie Uggams, John Ortiz, Adam Brody, Keith David, like really well-seasoned character actors who know comedy and drama at the same time. And just, I was falling over in my seat. I was laughing so hard. Like the insight that Cord Jefferson brings to this whole idea of, is there a proper way to portray black people in America? That's a discussion that's been going on for decades. I remember having college classes where we talked about it with regards to, you know, the Cosby Show, not knowing what we know now, and the Proud Family and Family Matters and all these other shows. Like, is there a proper way to depict the black experience? And this is a stellar continuation of that conversation. Like, and the weird thing is, as much as I fawn over this, in essence, I'm part of the joke, because half of the humor is the fact that, you know, white people are taking opportunities to fawn over black voices. For me, it's because I appreciate the humor. I'm not trying to say something for the sake of optics or political correctness as the characters in the film do, but I can easily appreciate the fact that this very joke can be spun on me right now, and I'm totally good with it. I'm in on it. Sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it sounds almost like familiar territory from something like Bamboozled, Spike Lee's Bamboozled.
Yep.
And things like that. You mentioned you think that Jeffrey Wright might get an Oscar nomination, but is this film releasing this year or next year?
It is still on the schedule as far as I'm aware. It's coming out in December. Fingers crossed that holds. because that's not always been the case, but as far as I'm aware, it's still going to come out I believe December 22nd or December 15th is the qualifying run, then it'll expand the week after. It was originally supposed to come out first week of November, but it was pushed, so it's possible the strikes could, you know, crash it again. I sincerely hope not, because, yeah, this is, again, a great screenplay, great performances, worthy of consideration. And I can, especially with the field now permanently expanded to 10, I can see a backdoor Best Picture nomination here. The Peasants, this is Poland's submission for international feature, and it's done by Hugh and DK Welchman. This is the same creative team that did Loving Vincent back in 2017, one of the best animated films ever made, as far as I'm concerned. And this movie is kind of done in a similar style. They filmed it as if it was a live action film with the actors on camera and everything. And then artists from four different countries created tens of thousands of oil paintings in the style of Polish artists of the 20th century to make up the frames for what is the final film. And then you have a different set of animators come in and clean it all up and make sure it all edits together. It's gorgeous. Like, eye-poppingly gorgeous. I mean, when I saw, you know, promotional stills for this, I thought it was a live-action movie, like maybe with a slight filter on the lens, you know, just for effect, like more saturated colors or something like that. It wasn't until I got in the seat and Hugh and DK Welchman come on the screen to describe it, bringing some of the oil paintings with them, that's like, oh wow, we're doing this again. We're doing a second Loving Vincent, this time in Polish. And in the six intervening years, the skill has gone up a level to the point where the way the secondary animators kind of blend everything together and create these little brush strokes all along the periphery in the background, it creates a false depth of field. So there are moments when it almost looks 3D, which is insane. That's the artistic side of it. From the narrative and story side, this is based on a Polish novel of the same title called The Peasants, which the Welchman showed it to us in the theater. It's about as thick as War and Peace, but it won the Nobel Prize, and it's kind of like standard curriculum for Polish high school students. Like, it's that ingrained in society now. And what it is, it's about a woman named Jagna, who is the object of affection for basically every young man in her small farming village at the turn of the 20th century. She eventually is, for all intents and purposes, sold into marriage to this old man named Bornia, who's an older widower, but he's also the richest and most influential man in the town. There's this really cool running ceremony where basically if a man gives you a shot of vodka and you drink it, that's a marriage proposal. Like that's, for a society of potato farmers, that's weirdly apropos. And then the story takes place over the course of the year. It's divided up into the four seasons. And it becomes more and more this searing portrait of misogyny and groupthink, because this beautiful young woman who wants to have, you know, a romantic and sexual identity of her own is eventually turned into a pariah and the scapegoat for all the town's problems because she dares have sex. So it's weirdly poignant for this day and age. It really shouldn't be, but it is. And again, the performances of these actors comes through the animation in ways you just wouldn't expect. Like with Loving Vincent, a lot of the cast, like Saoirse Ronan and all them, they were basically picked because they looked like the subjects of Van Gogh's paintings. Here, we just have a really strong cast that's animated around, and again, they could convince you that it's real, that it's just a filter over a live film. It's that strong.
But this is animation, right? It's not like, it's not motion capture or something like that.
It's fully animated. Like I said, they filmed as if they filmed live action, and then the cells, the frames of the live action were then converted into painting. Like basically, you know, you hand an artist, you know, a second worth of film, and it's their job to then create 24 paintings to match it.
This must have taken forever to make, right?
Over the course of about 4 years, yeah. And they actually had to suspend production temporarily because one of their animation houses was in Ukraine at the start of the Russian invasion. So they had to evacuate all those people, have them start working in Poland. And then once it was safe to return, get them back home and start the process up all over again. Like they had some real world setbacks with this, but God, it's just so beautiful. The Bike Riders. This is a lot of fun. To be clear, this is not a prestige film. I mean, you could have probably maybe competed for a couple of technicals like the cinematography and the editing and maybe backdoor performance nominations for Tom Hardy and Jodie Comer. But really, this is just a fun, character-driven adventure film, kind of in the vein of Rebel Without a Cause and Easy Rider. It even directly references Marlon Brando in The Wild One. It's a movie about a motorcycle gang. I mean, it's loosely based on this book by a guy named Danny Lyne, who's a political activist and a photojournalist. Back in the 60s and 70s, he was embedded with the Chicago branch of, I believe, the Outlaws Motorcycle Club. And he did these interviews with both the bikers and their wives to kind of like get a sense of what biker culture really was back in the anti-establishment 60s. And it's those kind of interviews that inspire the film. Danny Lyon here is played by Mike Faist, who was Riff in the West Side Story remake. One of the best things about that movie that I kind of like, but not really. He was absolutely great. And then, of course, like I said, you have Tom Hardy as Johnny. He's the leader of what they call the Vandals in here. You know, names are changed to protect the innocent. Jodie Comer plays Kathy, who's the wife of Benny, played by Austin Butler, coming off of his Best Actor nomination for Elvis earlier this year. Most of the material is based on the interviews with Kathy. First of all, I just love how well Jodie Comer and Tom Hardy as British people affect Midwestern accents. It's surprisingly good. There's this romanticism in the simple act of drinking a beer or, you know, having a pig roast barbecue and like everything like that. Like, my stepfather was in a motorcycle club for a long time, and I got exposed to that culture when I was a teenager a little bit. Once you get over the black lung from all the people smoking around you, there was a lot of fun to be had, and there were these weird traditions, unwritten rules, and hierarchies, you know, when you could wear your colors, when you couldn't, whose territory was whose. Like, it always seemed like it was just dangling on the edge of, like, right on the precipice of something more sinister than it ever was. But there was also something fascinating about it, and I think Jeff Nichols, who directed this, I think he captures that quite well. The sad part, like I said, literally on the Friday night that this, you know, screened at AFI Fest, the studio pulled it off the schedule because of the SAG-AFTRA strike that had still not been resolved. And it always bugs me because they themselves, like the studio, had advertised this film for more than a month. You know, I had seen the trailers in the theaters because I was getting excited for it. And then they decide, well, be excited, but you know how art works. You can't see it unless we can stick Tom Hardy on Colbert to plug it for 2.5 minutes. It's like, whatever. But, you know, the whole point of award season baiting is that you're using the awards to drive your marketing, not the actors themselves. But I don't make these decisions. It's clearly above my pay grade. But hopefully the strike gets resolved and it gets either put back on the schedule for December like it was originally planned, or not buried in the studio dumping ground of January and February next year. Like, because again, it's not the greatest thing that's ever, you know, been made, but there's just something to be said for a good solid popcorn movie that comes out in the fall. Like, we see so many of them in the summer, but this is cinematic comfort food, and it's really well done in that respect. Like, you have a really good supporting cast with like Michael Shannon and a few others. Like, I just sat there for 2 hours completely just turning my brain off and enjoying myself. And especially when you're doing so many films over the course of 5 days, you need that palate cleanser sometimes. You know, that Friday, I had only watched The Bike Riders and one other film called Occupied City, which was a 4-hour documentary. It was great. It was really well done, don't get me wrong. But after 4 hours, I needed to flush out my brain, and the Bike Riders was perfect for that.